Hi guys, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Mark Cooper-Jones of The Map Men, all about the world's worst country, a couple of parish notices from me, Patreon donors, anyone who has donated to us on patreon.com/worstfootforward, well, we've started a new monthly series for you guys. Everyone who donates $3 a month or more to us on Patreon is entitled to some bonus extra content each month. And for the next year, Ben and I are going to be setting each other monthly tasks to do. They'll be silly, they'll be very, very testing, to judge by how badly the first one went for me. And we'll be filming those and popping them up on Patreon for you guys to view and vote on the winner and so on. So if that sounds like something you'd like a little bit extra of and you want to help support the podcast along the way, go to patreon.com/worstfootforward and get involved on that. We had a lot of fun doing the first one of those. I set it and Ben spent most of the ensuing period telling me how he was going to get his revenge on me with the task he sets next month. So... may God have mercy on my soul. And thank you to those people who've written some nice reviews for us on iTunes and their various podcatchers recently. Please, if you can, spare a minute rating us 5 stars, writing a nice sentence or two on there, sharing the podcast. All of those things are greatly appreciated and help to keep us visible and get new listeners and all that sort of stuff. So please do that. Or give us a shout out on social media if you can. You can follow the podcast on Twitter. We're on @worstfoot. I'm on @basmaxday. Ben is on @benvandeveld. And you can also find us on Facebook, or if you look for the website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. You can also send us an email if you want to get in touch, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We have a couple of episodes that some Patreon donors actually have suggested topics for, World's Worst Coffee and World's Worst Coincidence, and we're trying to hunt down good guests for those topics. So if any of you guys have a brilliant idea, if you've got a connection with Mr. Nescafe himself, or something like that, you think, oh, I know exactly the person that Ben and Barry should get on the show for that topic. Do get in touch. That would be enormously helpful as well. Other than that, thank you to everyone who's been in touch with both Ben and myself over our various ailments and illnesses. Ben had his naughty tooth removed during the week. And I'm probably, I would say, 80% back to where I would like to be, having had my surgery last month as well. So thank you to all of you for... you are a lovely community to... be the very inept joint mayors of, I guess. Speaking of that, we mentioned ahead of a recent podcast that we were thinking of setting up a Discord channel for listeners and fans of the show to chat and exchange memes and ideas. A couple of people have said they would be interested if we set that up in helping moderate, and also, you know, they think it would be a fun thing for them to be involved in and ways for you guys to talk to each other and share your love of Worst Foot Forward and all of the worst things in the world. So, yeah. If a few more of you get in touch and say the same thing, if a few more of you think that that's something you'd like to be part of, then I will go about setting that up. But just want to gauge interest in that. So again, if you didn't get in touch previously, but you've been thinking, oh, I hope they do that, speak now or forever hold your peace. That's enough. World's Worst Country coming up next. Not as xenophobic as the title suggests. And I tell you, some of the big hitters, like the UK and the USA, you get off lightly in this. We found a lot of very silly things, so hope you all enjoy. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxday, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. I have to say, when I first heard this week's topic, I was all set to present my research on Piers Morgan, Donald Trump and Martin Shkreli, until I realised that my co-host's voice message had cut out before the final syllable and we're doing World's Worst Country this week. Alongside me is the plucky, independent country with the fine quality of life. He's nice for holiday, but I wouldn't want to live in him. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello, citizens, subjects and comrades, and a very happy new year to you. Obviously,
and to you.
You've been enjoying the lukewarm bubble bath of sick that is 2021.
At least it's lukewarm compared to last year.
Yeah, when it was ice cold. But we are. This is the first time me and Barry have recorded together, and also the first time since he has maintained his 100% record of being alive.
Yes, keeping that record going, undefeated so far by the Reaper. Yeah, no, it's been an interesting time, but it's nice to be back in the in Worstwood Forward Towers, aka our individual offices, back to the world of everything terrible, to escape from everything else that's actually terrible in the outside world.
Yeah, I mean, like, let's be fair, with the ever so slightly uplifting events of this week in the United States, like, firstly, that's disqualified them from the running of this week's show, but also, it feels like we're being the olive in the martini glass to a world that is feeling a little bit more optimistic. I mean, obviously, not on rainy fascist plague island over here. Everything's still shit here, but it feels like a small weight has been lifted from the world's shoulders.
Yeah, who'd have thought that all we needed was a 78-year-old granddad to show up and just make us feel a whole lot better? If Joe Biden doesn't offer us all a word as original and just say, it's all going to be all right. Now let's finish this Sudoku together. that's all we needed.
Right, let's introduce this week's guest. He is a writer, sketch performer, YouTuber, and geography teacher. His twin-pronged attack on infamy has come thanks to being one-third of acclaimed malapropistic sketch group Wit Tank, and more recently, alongside fellow pod guest Jay Foreman. With Jay, he has defeated YouTube's algorithms with his series Map Men, all about cartographical oddities and trivia, including episodes about Beer to Will, The Land That Nobody Wants, and also the name of a play by my co-host. Another episode called Who Owns the South China Sea, an undergraduate essay by me in 2003 that earned a grudging 2-2, and India versus Bangladesh, the world's worst border, an episode which has saved me and Barry a bunch of work. He's here, he's beautifully contoured, an absolute legend, and at the scale of 1-1. Please welcome Mark Cooper Jones.
Hello, thank you. That was so nice. I have some questions off the bat. First of all, Has Jay Foreman been on this?
Jay Foreman was our second ever guest.
He didn't tell me that. I told him I was doing this and he didn't tell me that. I thought I was the first Matt. That's so weird. Maybe he's completely forgotten.
It was about 4 years ago.
Yeah. No, but he knew. I said, I'm doing a Ben and Barry's podcast, and he immediately knew what it was. But yeah. He didn't say, I did that, which you'd think would be the first thing.
Yeah, he did. He did World's Worst Beatles song.
Did, yeah, he'd be good for that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He's an odd guy, though, isn't he, Jay? No, but we love him. Yeah, no, I'm actually not finished, though, Ben, because despite the litany of things that you introduced me as, you haven't introduced me as what is my current job, and you probably don't know, and that's because it's actually been a while since we've seen each other.
Yeah.
On the circuit, but I actually, I kind of, apart from the Matt Men side of things, I pretty much stopped doing comedy about 4 years ago, and I now work in documentaries. So that is life.
How is documentary making when you're not allowed to leave your house?
Yeah, it's hard. it's much harder. But actually, we are key workers. We're allowed to keep going. The producers of Gogglebox, not that that's what I am, are key workers.
No, they're not.
They are, and they're allowed to send their children to school because they produce Gogglebox.
Ben, how can we get key worker status so you can get your kids out the door as quickly as possible?
Exactly. Yeah. But no, we are. I'm currently working on a documentary which is about COVID, so it can feel quite bleak at times. But we have kind of taken a bit of a pause on filming because it just doesn't actually feel responsible to be going and filming people at the moment. I think we're hoping that it will. It's kind of quite a retrospective documentary, quite kind of looking back over a long period of time. And also we're working with the poet laureate, Simon Armitage, who's kind of writing some original poetry for it. So it is literally quite an artistic type of documentary and take. This is the kind of moment where you need your poet laureate to kind of make sense of this chaos that we have been living through. And actually, I mean, I'm not personally like a big poetry person, but it has genuinely been quite cathartic sometimes reading what he writes. Like, oh yeah, that is what we're all feeling. But anyway, we're not here to talk about that. Sorry, I have sent us down a very early diversion.
Welcome to the podcast that's all about diversions.
It was just a correction, Ben.
you've been put under starter's orders now, Ben.
I very much have. Well, we can tell that you are very good at A, making documentaries, and B, fastidious attention to detail. What is it that you are terrible at?
This took me no time to think of. And it would be the first thing my wife would say as well. And it's not something that as somebody who used to be a geography teacher and one of the Map Men, I'm all that comfortable admitting. But I have a not just terrible, but absent sense of direction. it kind of fits more broadly into a character trait of mine where I have very, very bad spatial intelligence. I'm terrible at art. I can't draw a cube. if I go into a building, like a sort of largish building, like maybe a store or something, and I take, you know, one 45 degree turn to the left and then one 90 degree turn to the right, I immediately don't know where the entrance is. I wouldn't be able to point you in the direction of it. I lose my bearing so easily. Or like kind of in a two-story building, right? Like you're just your own house. If you have a two-story building house, which I don't, but you know, I can't imagine what room is above another room unless I draw a linear line in my head. So I go right, I go straight, I go left, and then up the stairs, and then a left turn, and that would be a bit. I just can't imagine space properly.
Wow.
And I think that's why I like maps.
You're like the world's worst Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Like, Indy needs the map. And until he has the map, he's not going to be able to find his way through this labyrinth of caves and tunnels. We're just going to stay here until...
No, caves, absolute nightmare of mine. Terrified of them.
Yeah, I've got a good sense of direction. My husband doesn't, which is really weird because he's, you know, quite practical and artistic and very good at envisioning things. And so it always amazes me that... Or it always amazes him when, like, if I've been one place once 10 years ago, I will still go, oh yeah, there's going to be, the cafe is down there, and I think the room that we're looking for is that way. And he's like, how do you do that? I think it's actually genuinely probably an element of my social anxiety. I always need to know where the escape routes are.
I've got something kind of similar in that I don't trust my instinct on directions, but so I second guess myself. I'll be like, right, what's the way? Well, my gut says left, so I'm going to turn right. And every time I get it wrong.
You have an instinct to go against your instincts, and the only instinct that is a bad instinct is that one.
We're doing, appropriately enough, given Mark's YouTube series, The World's Worst Country. This could get hella xenophobic hella fast, so we thought Ben would be the appropriate person to lead us off.
Essentially, the reason why we're doing this episode is because over our previous episodes, various micronations come up and they are just a delight. They're one of my favourite things to research. And almost every time they've been on the podcast, they've been founded by a bunch of eccentric multimillionaire libertarians. And whilst the story is funny, the dramatis personae are frustrating and look like the sort of people who would be backing the attack on the Capitol from a couple of weeks ago. So I wanted to find some alternative micronations that would sometimes warm the cockles of our heart. So first of all, we're going to go to New Zealand and a place called Wangamamona, which was a small township in the Stratford district. And it's a tiny, tiny, tiny place. And in 1989... the regional boundaries were redrawn, and residents objected to this, and they responded by declaring themselves the Republic of Wangamamona. And basically, that's it as far as it's happened from them. They've got no constitution, no standing army, none of that, but every year they hold a celebratory Republic Day during which a vote for the president is held. And I would like to tell you about some of the Republic of Wangamamona's former presidents.
Please do.
From 1989 to 1999, there was Ian Kiestrup, and he was put on the ballot without his knowledge and then served 10 years as president.
Okay, that's incredible.
That's really good.
What? Who did that? Was it a sort of a practical joke? Was it?
Yeah. Did they maintain the fiction? Did they like keep like a mate would bring him to a supermarket and they go, "Oh, there's a ribbon in the way. Will you just take the scissors and cut the ribbon so we can walk into the supermarket?" Like secretly getting him to carry out presidential duties, but never telling him.
I guess so. Just an incredibly long-standing prank. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Is it usually a 10-year term? I mean, did he have to stand for some sort of re-election in that, and did he put his name on the ballot the second time in the interim, or...
That's a good question. No, I mean, as far as I can understand, it seems to be like the American Supreme Court, that it's a lifetime of service.
Oh, my God.
From my reading, I couldn't find a challenger to him, but after 10 years, he gave up the post and was succeeded by Billy Gumboot, which you might think is an odd name for a person, and you'd be right, because it's a appropriate name for a goat. And he won the election by a landslide and very, very nobly died in office 18 months after being elected.
But that makes me question whether Ian was a really good, bad president then, if a goat managed to eventually succeed him. Or was he really good like Obama, and they went, now we need to go to the other end of the scale and we need to elect a Trump.
We need change, any kind of change, even if it is a goat. So far, nobody has, by the sounds of it, because I assume the goat didn't actually put their name on the ballot themselves.
Yeah.
It would appear not, and neither was Billy's successor, Ty the Poodle. And this is where things get controversial in the Republic, because Ty only served for a year because Ty was attacked by a mastiff. Some in the community speculated that it was an assassination attempt. So with three presidents in, and we've already got some severe constitutional crises occurring.
Now, when you say there are three presidents in, were they the first three presidents?
They were the first three presidents.
Oh, God, just thought you'd pick the best ones.
Put them all on Mount Rushmore. that's a hell of a triptych.
Yeah, it'll look like a Looney Tunes cartoon. Things, like, escalated from there. After that, you get another human who was a local garage owner, fine, called Sir Myrtle the Turtle Kennard.
distressingly not a turtle.
Distressingly not a turtle, yeah. And he, now, his electoral campaign, for any budding cephologists out there, is rather baffling, because in his first election, he defeated President Kiestrup, who came back onto the ballot again. Clearly, he wanted a bit more time in office, the first president. Mm-hmm. He was re-elected in 2009 by one vote, but then again by a landslide in 2011. So it's clearly a very wild and chaotic electorate that they've got in this republic.
He ruled with an iron fist.
What's the population?
Mm. About 50.
Oh my gosh.
Then winning by one vote is quite a hefty landslide. I mean, that's 2% of the electorate, yeah.
And the present president is someone called John Hurley, who was elected ahead of someone called Lily Jiao, who was a human pretending to be a cat, and Ted, who was a cat who was actually a cat.
What I would say is, these 50 people deserve their own country, because they've got some absolutely cracking characters there. You know, they feel like a unique population.
Yes, they absolutely do.
That formation then, it was something to do with, you know, the national government, the New Zealand government, was redrawing some national boundaries, and they kicked off about that. Is there any more detail on that? Because that's quite a strange thing to think, you know, like, I'm not having this regional boundary redrawn like that. I want to be my own country. I mean, that, you know.
It does feel like they went for the nuclear option. They wanted to be in one catchment area rather than another. And I don't know any more detail than that, but I presume that they just went, right, well, fuck it. If we can't be exactly where we want to be in New Zealand, we're going to be our own country.
Mm-hmm. It's quite dramatic.
Yeah, there's a similar story that gets even more out of hand from the United States in 1982. And this is taking us to Florida. And I'm going to tell you about somewhere called the Conch Republic. And in 1982, the American Border Patrol set up a roadblock and inspection point on a highway near Florida Keys, and vehicles were stopped and searched for narcotics and illegal immigrants. And the Key West City Council complained about this and said this was an inconvenience and it hurt our tourism. And so when their complaints were unanswered, they again went nuclear and declared Key West's independence on April the 23rd, 1982. Stand by for the most astonishing amount of chutzpah you're ever going to hear from a small independent state. They considered, since the federal government had set up what was essentially a border station, as if they were a foreign nation, they may as well become one. And so, as part of their protest, their mayor got promoted to prime minister, and his first action as prime minister of the Conch Republic was to declare war on the United States of America. He quickly surrendered 1 minute later and then immediately applied to them for $1 billion in foreign aid.
That's excellent, isn't it?
That's the most Florida thing ever.
It is. Yeah. The whole thing is so Florida. I think I'd come across this before. I have a feeling that roadblock, right? Because it's such an interesting area, isn't it? Like, I mean, Florida is such an interesting state, but you've got such an interesting mix of this kind of really wealthy kind of gauche people who go to Florida. I mean, you know, Trump obviously bases himself there. And you've got quite a lot of immigration and quite a lot of crime, and that's why they do Grand Theft Auto games are always set in Miami or whatever. I think the roadblock was something to do with like drugs trafficking and crime initially, and the reason they all kicked off about it in the Keys is because, you know, they don't like roadblocks. They don't like to even pretend they have, like, you know, problems and gangs and drugs and stuff, and it was affecting tourism as well. So they were like, we can't have this kind of very visible problem in the middle of our interstate. The mayor slash president has kind of basically used it as a big tourism opportunity now, hasn't it? They really try to maximize this, come and get a passport, whatever it might be. I think they celebrate Independence Day and that kind of thing.
They do. They really lean into it. They also have, they've got an army and a navy and an air force, which is used almost exclusively for battle recreations. They describe it as the Great Sea Battle of 1982. The other thing that they also recreate is the invasion of 1995. It was reported that the 478th Civil Affairs Battalion of the US Army was going to conduct training exercises to simulate the invasion of a foreign island. And they were going to land on Key West and pretend that the islanders were foreign. But no one from the Civil Affairs Battalion notified the Conch Republic, and so they basically, the Prime Minister went, right, publicity time, guys. So he mobilized the island for a full-scale war.
Oh my god, he sent
a schooner out to attack the incoming Coast Guard with water balloons and bits of stale Cuban bread, and the Coast Guard responded by using their very strong fire hoses at them to end the battle extremely quickly.
It sounds like the deleted episode of Dad's Army,
yeah.
where the Germans now actually invade Warmington-on-Sea.
They've got real strong Dad's Army vibes.
Yeah.
Talking of World War II, I've got one little sliver before I give you my suggestion. This is another tiny micronation called the Republic of Morak Songrati Medes, which was set up on the Spratly Islands by a British naval captain called James George Meads. And the Spratly Islands are somewhere in the South China Sea. And in 1877, Meads laid claims to them and described himself as King James I. And descendants of him continue to say that they have legitimacy over these islands and their resources, even though there's no contemporary evidence of the existence of the state, no reliable information about Meads' life, and his name doesn't appear anywhere in the British archives. What I love, though, is that in 1914, a rival entity was started up there called the Kingdom of Humanity under the leadership of Meads' son. And there became a factional battle between the Kingdom of Humanity and the Morak Songrati Meads Republic. And this continued all the way through World War II, even whilst they were occupied by Japanese troops. And I love the idea of this tiny little parochial battle for this little atoll in the South China Sea, and the Japanese learning up and being like, lads, there's something a bit bigger going on that you need to know about.
Yes. Big picture, little picture.
Yeah.
That's great. It's basically an extended family argument.
Yeah, exactly what it is. I mean, to be fair, you could say that about the history of the Valois and the Bourbons and the Habsburgs. It's all little arguments go out of hand. But for my suggestion, we're going to talk about a man who very much belongs on the show, a chap from Evergreen Park in Illinois called James Thomas Mangan. He turned his hands to a number of different things. He authored about 20 books. He wrote a song that Irving Berlin described as the worst ever written.
What would Irving Berlin know?
Well, what would he know? But his great claim was creating the nation of celestial space, known as Celestia. And Celestia comprised of the entirety of outer space. He laid claim to as the founder and first representative on the 1st of January 1949. And it apparently started, he was having a chat with a business partner, and his business partner just an offhand comment. They were looking up at the sky and he went, "Oh, there's plenty of stuff out there." And Mangan apparently turned to him and went, "I wonder who owns it." So he then very quickly presented a charter of Celestia to his local county recorder of deeds, but they refused to record it.
That kind of thing is just off the scale, isn't it? Like, you're talking about owning land in a kind of in a legal space that isn't covered by anything, and you go to your county, you know,
yeah,
a local county, and go, "Do you have the legislative authority by any chance to cede me the universe?" I mean, it gets to a really interesting question, isn't it? Because there always has to be a point at which, when you first decide you're going to own something, you know, before there are laws, before there are courts, somebody has to go, "This piece of paper is authority."
Yeah.
Somebody has to make that up, and everyone goes, "Yes, a signature will be the thing that we all agree is important and we will all respect forever." And that's always a slightly corrupt moment, I think, because it's just the person who's most powerful at the time making up that rule and saying, "Right, now this is the real thing. This is the real thing, and I own it all."
But he's just wandered into a room where there's like a traffic warden's probably sat there just off duty.
Exactly. But I mean, in one way, it's no different to any other territorial claim back when territories were first being sort of officially claimed and boundaries were being drawn up. But you do have to admire. It's just so incongruous going to your local county for the whole of space. Sorry, Ben, but how did it turn out?
He was not a man to be deterred. So he appealed to the state attorney general, who delivered a 2,000-word opinion in his favour and had the charter put on the recorder. But then he went even bigger. He was very active in pursuing claims on behalf of Celestia. He notified the US, the USSR, the United Kingdom, the United Nations, and he told them that Celestia had banned atmospheric nuclear tests. They ignored him. And obviously, there's a little bit of the amateur libertarian around him, because Celestia was a nation free of democracy and taxes, but also free of warfare. And he created a Celestian flag, which was a blue hashtag or sharp symbol on it within a white disc, because the hashtag is apparently the ancient printer's symbol for space. And in 1948, that flag, in a television broadcast to millions across the US, was raised at the United Nations building in New York City.
Wow.
Some people kind of liked his approach. He made specific coins for it called Celestons and Jewels, and he decided to use, instead of the gold or silver standard he created in his world, the energy standard. He also, inspired by Liechtenstein, created lots of stamps, which would be naturally rare and would raise lots of money.
Space inspired by Liechtenstein.
Yeah.
Okay.
He even sent stamps, money, and passports to some of the astronauts. John Glenn personally thanked Mangan for his passport to the moon.
Wow.
Ben.
Yeah.
Ben, this man isn't well.
But he's really enjoyably unwell. The final coda to this is his descendants. Obviously, after his death, this all sort of faded away.
Sorry, Ben. Presumably, when he died, he had to be buried on Earth, or did they shoot him into space to return him to his homeland? Or did they do like an ancient romantic figure, where his body is buried on Earth, but his heart has been shot into the moon?
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd like to hope that was that NASA found somewhere in their budget to make that happen.
Yeah. He never went there, presumably. I mean,
no, he was a fat man from the Midwest. He was not an astronaut.
I do think I think you are in very, very dubious territory when you haven't been to the place that you're claiming. I mean, the British Empire was many bad things, but at least we went there.
Yeah.
We weren't just going, "Yes, that is ours and that is ours."
You make an appointment, you keep it when you're running an empire.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was survived by his children and grandchildren, who have excellent monikers. His daughter, Ruth Mangan, was known as the Princess of the Nation of Celestial Space. And his grandsons, Glenn, the Duke of Mars, Dean, the Duke of Selenia, and Todd, the Duke of the Milky Way.
Wow. That's my Grindr profile name.
Yeah. Oh, it's either that or the Duke of the Black Hole, isn't it?
Well, I thought the Tin White Duke had been taken, so...
Yeah.
So, I don't think this is the worst nation at all. I think this is sort of a great idea, because like you say, there are a lot of quite repetitive micronations out there, you know, people who believe in grand libertarian ideas. But there's a couple of artists whose names I can't remember, but they sound a lot like Elgaland Vargaland, I think, because that is the name of their country, Elgaland Vargaland. And their country is all of the borders between countries. So already we can see they're artists. They've got quite a conceptual approach to this. And when you enter Elgaland Vargaland when you cross from one country to another. It is the space in between. It is a postmodern nation.
They're the liminal spaces.
It is the liminal spaces. And they see anybody who is in a state of transition at any point in their life, and they specifically talk about, I can't remember the name of it. There's a kind of technical name for that bit between being asleep and being awake. It's like hip something.
Hypnagogia, maybe?
The hypnagogia, I'm not sure. But anybody who is in that state is in Elgaland Vargaland, technically. That you suddenly become a citizen for that brief moment. And they've also claimed as their citizens all of the dead. So everyone who is dead goes to Elgaland Vargaland. It's wonderful.
So they've got the highest population of any
exactly,
nation.
Exactly, they are. But there are some other sort of constitutional and governance issues there. I quite like that. I quite like some of the sort of more tongue-in-cheek ones where they're just sort of like playing with it and finding out what they can do. And then there's some really silly ones like I came across doing a bit of research, this the Kingdom of Y in Australia.
Is that the letter Y or the question?
It is a bit of both. It's spelled W-Y, and it's this basically raging Aussie who spent something like 20 years in a really kind of mundane, boring battle with his whatever kind of local council in a suburb of Sydney, because he wanted a driveway to go over a road that was outside his house. He wanted his driveway to basically be a bridge over a road, and he kept applying. I don't really know the details of this, but like he kept applying for the council's permission to build this thing. And after a 20-year dispute, they denied him, and then he succeeded from Mossman, which is the name of the suburb. He said he wasn't succeeding from Australia, but he was succeeding from the county of Mossman. He set up the Kingdom of Y, and then went down that route that kind of a lot of these people do, is slightly eccentric, and they start issuing passports, having their own currency. You know, they start making money off people from the rest of the world who find it an interesting concept, buying citizenship for like $20 a year or whatever.
As Ben's story earlier was very Florida, that's a very Aussie story.
Yeah, the Kingdom of fucking why, mate? Why can't I do it? Why not? Just tell me why. My pick is closer to home, much closer to home than Ben's. Again, this was like instant. As soon as you asked me to come on this, it was like the world's worst country. It's like, yes, this is something I love. So it is the sovereign nation of Forvik, or Forwick, Forewick, which is an island, a tiny, tiny island in the Shetlands. So sort of, you know, halfway between Scotland and Scandinavia, which is where the dispute sort of arises, although, the dispute is very, very suspect. It is claimed as a crown dependency by a chap called Stuart Hill, who's not Scottish, he's English. A sharp intake of breath from Ben there, who's already got incredibly nervous about where this might be going. The thing about Stuart, there's a lot of things about Stuart. He's an old man now, really, and he's obviously a little bit eccentric as well, but he's doing this completely in earnest. There's nothing tongue-in-cheek. He is deadly, deadly serious that Forvik now is a sort of crown dependency, not part of the UK, and that he is the acting first minister of Forvik. I'll start with the kind of where his claim comes, and then I'll tell you the backstory to Stuart, which is the best part. The Shetlands used to belong to the Danes/Norwegians, and King Christian the something, they're all Christian, I think, was pretty strapped for cash, and his daughter Margaret was marrying King James the Second's of Scotland's son, King James III, who was going to be King James III, and he needed a dowry. So he kind of gave the Shetland Islands to Scotland, but it was kind of not very ratified. It was like, yeah, have these. No one really, again, no one re-signed anything.
County. No one asked the Shetlanders where they wanted to be.
Exactly. It was meant to be sort of, I think, a bit of a temporary arrangement, but it just never really got sorted out.
Is it also that because with the Shetlands, they're a very sort of scattered archipelago, so when it's in the 13th, 14th century, you go, yeah, have a number of islands, but they haven't really accounted for all of them.
That's probably the case as well. But Stuart Hill, he personally claimed ownership of Forvik, but he also campaigns on behalf of all the Shetlands to be independent. He's sort of doing two movements at once in a way. So obviously, you know, Stuart's from Suffolk. He's a bit of a strange guy. How does he end up on the Shetlands? How does he end up as part of Forvik? Well, being First Minister of Forvik is not what Stuart Hill is most famous for. He is most famous for his nickname, Captain Calamity.
Oh no.
In 2001, I think it was, to circumnavigate the British Isles as a sailor, but he's not a sailor. He basically kind of appropriated a dinghy, and I really mean a tiny dinghy. He stuck a windsurfing board sail in it and kind of mangled this boat together. And it is, you can look a picture of this, right? It is literally a windsurf sail in a dinghy. And then he sits in it and tries to go around the British Isles, and he can't really sail. As soon as he set off, he crashed into another boat. Like within 1 minute, he'd crashed into another boat.
Wow.
And during his attempt, which were never completed, to circumvent to circumnavigate the British Isles, he's reported to have called out the RNLI between 5 and 9 times for serious incidents, and 2 additional helicopter call out because he can't sail. He ends up going into a really busy shipping lane where he's just doing circles. His mast breaks in 2 as he's going around. He doesn't know anything, right? He's a calamity. He goes into an area of the sea that's used for RAF tornado bombing practices. He develops an allergic reaction to the resin he's used on the hull of his boat. Severe allergic reaction to it. His radio kind of breaks numerous times, and he ends up like just plentiful mayday calls. And he's raising money for charity doing this circumventing of the British Isles. He costs the RNLI so much more that he may be raised from it. And but he always like tries to refuse their help. He's like, no, I'm fine.
Like, oh,
and they're
wow.
Like, you're not fine. You're in the middle of a storm and your sail is broken. He's quite kind of, I kind of admire him because he's quite brave. Anyway, at one point he ends up in the Shetlands in hospital with hypothermia. And it's there that he kind of somehow comes across Forvik. I'm not really sure the details of that, but he likes the Shetlands. He runs aground or whatever it is in the Shetlands, and he's like, I'm going to spend a bit of time here. Presumably he's got to recover from this latest hospitalization. And he likes it so much, he decides, obviously, that he wants to stay there. And he then sort of, you know, dubiously starts looking through the libraries and deciding that the Shetlands actually isn't owned by Scotland or indeed anybody. And that, therefore, Forvik, which is one of the islands he's clearly come across, and nobody lives on it, is his to claim. So Forvik is a kind of 1 hectare bit of land, and he needs to test his new judicial power. So he tries to get arrested so he can challenge the Scottish courts. Honestly, but he fails. He can't get arrested. He's quoted as saying, I found it incredibly difficult to get arrested.
That feels like a lovely little euphemism. Or look at it, she couldn't get arrested in Forvik.
Yeah. Well, you can't, there's no police there. So
yeah.
So what he's doing is he's building on it and then writing to the Scottish government to say, I'm building without planning permission. You can come and arrest me. Yeah. And he says, I'm doing work on the seabed around Forvik. Come and arrest me. Which he is. He's putting in devices to stop motor-propelled boats landing on Forvik. And in the end, he does manage to get himself arrested by... and it's through road tax evasion. So he basically gets an old van and he paints consular vehicle number 2 on the side of it.
Did he have a number 1?
Nobody knows what happened to consular vehicle number 1.
Oh, presumably it was the dinghy.
It was the dinghy, yeah. The dinghy had a name. It was called Maximum Exposure.
Why has he named his dinghy over a Steven Seagal movie? If I told you Steven Seagal was in Maximum Exposure, you'd be like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, he certainly got that both to the elements and to the British press in the end. he ends up driving this consular vehicle on whatever, some mainland Shetland, and they arrest him because he's got a fake number plate. He's obviously not insured, and the vehicle's not registered. So then he goes to court and he challenges the court's authority while he's in court, and they sentence him to 100 hours of community service. He's actually also now done two prison sentences for kind of defying the courts a series of times. So it's all a little bit sad as well. Like, he really does believe in this project and is willing to go to jail for it. And you sort of admire him for just standing up to it. He's obviously never going to get anywhere. He stood in 2017, he stood for election in the Shetland general election. The good news is he got 245 votes, but the bad news is he came last.
What do the other people of Forvik think about him? Is he...
The population is one.
It's just, and has he built his own...
He has built some kind of accommodation on it, yes.
Can we point out, though, that Ben, you mentioned Cephalogy earlier, he obviously carried the Forvik area of his constituency with 100% of the vote.
Yes, he did, that's very good. Yeah. You can imagine John King on CNN.
Yeah.
We're still waiting for Forvik to come in.
There is still a dump to come from Forvik at some point.
So he's not one of these who professes all these kind of really big liberal ideas. It's not about that for him. It's about a man should be able to own the land that he lives on, I think, a little bit. Plus, he's also sort of fighting for Shetland independence, as I said. But, I mean, it's sad because he's clearly completely lost the plot. But I really admire the bravery of an Englishman claiming a bit of Scotland for his own.
With his navy of a single dinghy and his army of a mounted cavalry of Shetland ponies.
Yeah, we've discovered what happens when you drink too much seawater.
Yeah.
After he got his first conviction, I think it was, he was quoted in the press as saying, "I'm right and they're wrong."
I mean, to be fair to him, that has underpinned every single claim for nationhood for the past 10,000 years.
Yes, it has, yeah.
How do you pick the worst nation? How do you pick the best nation? I just looked at nations that have nice shapes. When you extract them, Italy obviously is the classic. If you were ranking countries by shape, Italy's top of the list every time. But if you like isolate the silhouettes of some other countries, Benin, the nation of Benin, looks like a torch. It's like quite a squared off bit and then a nice flame at the top. Mm-hmm. The island of Sri Lanka also looks a bit like a torch. Cyprus doesn't really look like anything, but it's got a really pleasing shape to the extent that they stick it on their flag and everything.
It's a bit like a narwhal.
Oh, yeah, it is a little bit. Yeah. Gambia is like a sliver along a river. So if you take Gambia itself, it just looks like a river or a snake or something. But my favourite one is, I did not know this. Everyone who's listening, go and Google the words UAE silhouette. And it's a kangaroo, guys.
No.
The United Arab Emirates looks like a kangaroo. Honestly, Google it right now. Just look at it.
I'm going to go on it right now.
I mean, sort of.
It's a bloody kangaroo, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, no, you say it's a kangaroo. It is a kangaroo / mermaid.
It's a kangaroo with a bustle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? Borders in general. We're not doing world's worst border or anything, but maybe that's one to do down the way. But you do get some interesting disputes and border issues. You mentioned Birta Wil earlier on, which is a tract of basically just desert between Egypt and Sudan. And basically, neither Egypt or Sudan want to claim responsibility for it because it would mean accepting that their country was slightly smaller due to the redrawing of the border by the British in the early 1900s. There's a similar area between Serbia and Croatia.
Lieberland.
Yes, Lieberland. Yeah. And the island of Sega Island. Basically, the Danube runs down between the two countries. And both, you know, where do you put the border when your border is a river? Serbia says the border should be right down the middle of it. Croatia says they should follow the old shape of the river, the previous course of it, which so Croatia can claim an extra 10,000 hectares on the Serbian side. So it also, by that fact, doesn't want to claim a 2,000 hectare little island on its side of the river because it wants to claim a different bit. But Serbia obviously doesn't want to claim that island because it wants to keep its 10,000 hectares. So it's another one of these.
It's tricky, that, isn't it? Because you say the border is the river and you think, well, this is probably never going to be a problem. But of course, rivers move over time. Because
yeah,
when
exactly.
They originally do draw the border, that is where it was, but then you can't just keep losing territory as the river moves.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really fair.
Yeah, yeah, it's a dead after. But so that they're examples of terra nullius, basically non-claimed territories, and because they're between two existing countries, it's quite hard for anyone else to get to them.
Can I just jump in on Beer to Will as well? Because I know we did do a video about it with Matt then, but there was something that came up in it that we never talked about, which is really funny. So this guy, Jeremiah Heaton, does claim Beer to Will for his own because it's terra nullius. He's an American guy who just wanted his daughter to be a real-life princess, is what
yes.
he said. So he's got this kind of really glossy video, like the land of Beer to Will. Like, it's going to be a land where we're leaders in agriculture and leaders in medicine. And like you say, it's just a bit of desert. But he's put together this glossy video. And the bit where he's talking about science, he's obviously kind of trying to put together some footage to show his vision for Beer to Will. There's this scientist, there's somebody in a lab coat, right, being filmed with quite a good camera, right, and they're holding a test tube and the test tube has just got a bit of basil in it. My favorite bit is just a scientist looking at a small stalk of basil in a test tube as if that is the future of science.
I also like the village of La Cour, which is a village right on the border between France and Switzerland. Like, literally, half the village is in France and half the village is in Switzerland. In fact, some buildings have the border running right through them, one of them being the Hotel Arbez. They use it as a selling point because the border actually runs right through the double bed in the honeymoon suite. So, but during World War II... it was a really interesting place to be because France was occupied by the Germans and Switzerland was neutral and independent. And so, apparently, this may or may not be true, on some occasions the French side of the hotel hosted German soldiers while members of the French resistance were hiding on the Swiss side.
That is an incredible game of hide and seek.
Yeah. and also, do you know where Tasmania's land border with Victoria is?
Is it in the sea?
Tasmania is the only Australian state which is an island, but it has a land border with Victoria, the southernmost state of Australia, mainland, by accident. So they drew a sea border. Victoria doesn't end at the coastline. It has a sea area designated to it, and then Tasmania, the island, has a sea area around it. And they drew a line at latitude 39 degrees and 12 minutes south. And it thought it was just across open water. And then they looked closely and the line actually crosses a tiny island.
Wow, that's
which
good.
Is 85 metres across, 93 yards. And so it's the shortest land border between the Australian states. It's officially the land border between Victoria and Tasmania. It's been rechristened Boundary Islet.
Like Spain. Spain has land borders with Portugal, Andorra, France and Morocco.
Yes, yeah, because it has that little enclave in North Africa. And one of my other favourite borders is in Marquette, or the Mark. It's a little uninhabited island in the Baltic Sea between Sweden and Finland, and it's been divided between Sweden and Finland, with a border drawn in 1809. But there's a lighthouse on the Finnish side, which has been unmanned for the last 4 years or so. And when it was originally built in the 1800s, the island was no man's land, so it was just built on the highest point of the island. The lighthouse, but the location selected was within the Swedish portion of the island. But now, with the, you know, they decided we need to sort of make things a little bit more official, so they've adjusted the border so the island, you know, the Swedish side is still Sweden and this lighthouse is in the Finnish side. But it means they had to redraw the border in such a way there would be no change in the amount of territory that both countries owned on the island. So it has this weird, like, inverted, jagged S-shaped border on the island because it basically has to go around a lighthouse complex.
That's really good. I'd never heard of that one as well. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really, really nice.
You're just giving me loads of fodder for Mad Men, you know. I mean,
that's it's great.
I have to discourage people from listening to this now, you know.
Yeah. No, we're
so it looks like it was my idea.
We're the gateway drug. We're the border control drug. You mentioned Liechtenstein earlier. I love Liechtenstein. It's one of the smallest countries in Europe. It's the fourth smallest behind Vatican City, Monaco, and San Marino. And before I get to why I love Liechtenstein, here's a fun fact about each of the other three. Vatican City, only 0.17 square miles, population of just 800, only about 450 of them hold actual citizenship. Monaco, you can fit over half the country's population inside the stadium of AS Monaco, which is the national football stadium. And in San Marino, Abraham Lincoln is an honorary citizen of San Marino. Because San Marino basically was the one bit of Italy that was never occupied by any of the, you know, the French or the Normans or any of the different nations who showed up and claimed bits of Italy before unification in the 1800s. And Abraham Lincoln wrote to them in the 1860s saying, although your dominion is small, nevertheless, your state is one of the most honoured throughout history. And they gave him citizenship to say thank you for your letter.
Wow. Yeah. Do you know what? Considering what's happened with Brexit, I'm quite tempted to do that.
Yeah,
just, you know, write to all of the EU nations and be like, if I send a polite enough letter, they might just let me in.
Yeah. What is San Marino like? Is it wealthy there? Are they quite wealthy?
I don't know how wealthy they are. I know Liechtenstein has the second highest per capita GDP in the world, only surpassed by Monaco's. Liechtenstein's is $165,000, which is pretty impressive. But one of Liechtenstein's ways of making money is... you can rent Liechtenstein. Since 2011, you can rent Liechtenstein on Airbnb.
What, for like a stag do? Or...
Yeah, whatever, you know. If you want hang like on, a weekend away.
Does everyone else clear out?
No, surely the way to do it is you rent Liechtenstein and then play a scale model version of Age of Empires.
Yeah. Oh, very good.
Liechtenstein is quite small. Like the largest city, its capital is Vaduz, which is about 5,400 people. It's the city of Shan is slightly larger with 6,000. And its closest airport isn't in Liechtenstein, it's in Zurich, which is an hour and a half away from Vaduz. They did a deal with Airbnb with a company called Rent a Village by Xnet. You can rent an Austrian village or different German towns or a Swiss ski resort and the Principality of Liechtenstein for $70,000 a night for a minimum of 2 nights. You can hire out Liechtenstein, which is about 61.7 square miles, has just 35,000 inhabitants. And Liechtenstein, apparently, on Airbnb, can accommodate between 450 and 900 people. It has 500 plus bedrooms and 500 plus bathrooms, and the cancellation policy is super strict. You get a 50% refund after booking if you cancel up to 30 days prior to arrival, otherwise no refund at all.
Mate, we've just given Liechtenstein and Airbnb a lot of free advertising here. I hope we're getting a kickback.
Oh, yeah. I mean, presumably they're going to immediately offer Worst for Forward a weekend away to Liechtenstein, yeah. Which is the second least visited country in Europe after San Marino.
Wow. Did you say how much it was to rent Liechtenstein?
$70,000 a night for a minimum of 2 nights.
Right. That feels like a steal, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does seem like
I think
pretty
it's
good.
A lot of money. I don't have that money, but it still feels like a steal.
Yeah, that's half of the GDP per capita of one person.
Goodness me. I never knew this.
Yeah, it's great. Then I looked at short-lived countries before I get to my choice. The Russian Federative Democratic Republic was established at lunchtime on the 19th of January 1918 and was dissolved before dinner the same day. It was basically in that in-betweeny bit when the Tsar had been overthrown and various different factions of the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and revolutionary Russians were trying to decide who was in charge. The All-Russian Constituent Assembly sat for a day, for 13 hours in fact, on the 18th, 19th of January 1918. And they were some people who were trying to decide what the country would be called before the Bolsheviks decided, no, we're in charge. And the Third All-Russian Congress of Soviets is the governing body. And so this Trotsky describes this constituent assembly as the deputies of the assembly brought candles with them in case the Bolsheviks cut off the electric light and a vast number of sandwiches in case their food be taken from them. Thus, democracy entered upon the struggle with dictatorship, heavily armed with sandwiches and candles.
I was going to say, for one of history's great bastards, he knows how to write a line that could come straight out of Victoria Wood's mouth.
Yeah, they declared the Russian Democratic Federative Republic, but this whole constituent assembly was dissolved that evening by the Bolsheviks, and so their word was immediately overruled.
Do you know what? This is just going to sound really stupid, but I don't really imagine the Russians having sandwiches back then.
Yeah.
Just don't see it as a very Russian food anyway.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I imagine kind of cabbage soups and some quite heavy dumplings or something. But I'm now imagining a sort of tray of white bread crusts cut off and egg cress sandwiches in the Bolshevik Revolution. But it doesn't quite match for me.
Maybe this was the sort of decadence that the Bolsheviks couldn't stand, which is why they dissolved the assembly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, bringing cabbage soup along to the Bolshevik Revolution presupposes Tupperware being around then. And I think that's
true, yeah.
That lasted slightly longer than Catalonia's independence. Basically, you remember they had a referendum on independence in 2017? In the run-up to it, Catalan president Charles Puigdemont, he said that we're going to declare independence 48 hours after the results of the referendum come in. And he addressed Parliament on October the 10th. And he said he considered the referendum valid and binding. Catalonia had voted for independence against Spanish government's will. They'd held this referendum. And Puigdemont used this wording: "I assume the mandate of the people for Catalonia to become an independent state in the form of a republic." Which is basically, it's a declaration of independence. He then added he would ask Parliament to suspend the effects of the Declaration of Independence so that in the coming weeks we can undertake a dialogue. Basically, people are like, has he just declared independence and then undeclared it? The entire gap between him declaring it to him suspending Parliament took 8 seconds. Which, it seemed like a bit of a cop-out. But a lot of people are like, he's going to declare independence, it's going to happen. And he kind of did, but he didn't. Because he was like, okay, we have a mandate. And I think he was going to use it as like a negotiation tactic. Okay. But yeah, so if you reckon that was him declaring independence, the entire independence of Catalonia lasted for 8 seconds, which, according to Microsoft, is as long as our average attention span.
I hope they enjoyed it. They'd only forgotten about it all by the 9th second anyway.
Yeah, exactly so. And I have one more. We mentioned Napoleon. We did a special episode about Napoleon recently. And his first exile was to the island of Elba. I didn't realise this. When he was exiled the first time round, he came back for the 100 days and Waterloo, and then he was exiled again to St. Helena. The first time he was exiled to Elba, which is a little island between Sardinia and Italy. It's quite close to the Tuscan coast. As part of the Treaty of Fontainebleau, which is, you know, how they negotiated what to do with Napoleon, they established it as a non-hereditary monarchy. So they made him the Prince of Elba. Okay, you're not the Emperor of France anymore, but, you know, it's only fair that we exile you to an island that we put you in charge of, and also you can have 1,000 soldiers with you. They gave him about 1,000 soldiers to keep with him. And he had a little navy. He was allowed,
a little navy for a little man.
Yeah, the navy had 66 men and one ship, the double-masted 18-gunned brig, the Inconstant, and two other little sloops used to accompany it. However, the guy who commanded the fleet, in inverted commas, was a guy called Lieutenant Tayad. He nearly lost the Inconstant in a storm. Imagine losing the entire navy of Elba.
Oh, God.
In one go.
And then having to explain yourself to Napoleon.
It's almost patronising, though, isn't it? It's like, no, don't throw your toys out the pram, Napoleon. You can have everything you had here, just a little bit smaller.
They gave him 2 million francs per year to be paid by France to maintain him. And to be fair to him, Napoleon was like, immediately, I'm all over this. It was like watching. It would be like if, like, Jurgen Klopp went and started managing an under-11s football team. He just threw himself into it. Like, he landed on the island. The mayor of the city on the island gave him the keys to the city. He wrote a 3-page constitution. He set up 5 government departments and a sovereign's council with 12 members. And he started modernizing the entire island, like instituting economic and social reforms, building bridges and roads, making decrees about agriculture methods and trash collections, you know, irrigation. He even passed a law prohibiting children from sleeping more than 5 to a bed.
Do you know what it was? It's clearly the French government were like, listen, we could imprison him on this island. We need to keep him busy.
Yeah,
Idle Napoleons cost lives.
But what I think actually what they ended up doing was like keeping his eye in. They still gave him the taste of power, whereas in St. Helena they were like, oh no, you're in St. Helena now. The guy who was in charge of him, like, keeping an eye on what he was in St. Helena was basically insisted on calling him General Napoleon the entire time, wouldn't call him Emperor or anything like that.
So it's like a French historic version of the film Hot Fuzz, really.
But my world's worst nation comes from the 1800s in California. This is a small town in Nevada County called Rough and Ready. It's on Highway 20 between Yuba City and Grass Valley. It's got a very small population now, less than 1,000 people. And it was named when the Rough and Ready Mining Company, led by Captain A.A. Townsend, settled the area in 1849. They discovered the gold nearby, and they named themselves after General Zachary Taylor, who had just been elected U.S. president. His nickname was Old Rough and Ready, and Captain Townsend had served under him in the army. California had three towns with this name, and this is the one that still exists. And this particular town of Rough and Ready, a year after it was founded in 1850, it decided it didn't want mining taxes and it didn't want prohibition, and so they decided to secede from the Union. A chap called Colonel E.F. Brundage came up with the concept of declaring it a separate republic. He issued a high-sounding manifesto, I'm quoting, about NevadaCounty.com. He called a huge meeting to organize the state of Rough and Ready, and about 100 men became very devoted to him and excitedly began working to build their new country. At this point, it's still basically a load of tents and bivouacs and shacks. It's not really much of a town. But they filed paperwork with the US government, creating the Great Republic of Rough and Ready on April the 7th, 1850.
And that's a great name, isn't
it? It's a really good name. They had a population of about 3,000 people at this point. You know, some of them were people who just showed up for the mining, so very transitory sort of population. But the country only lasted 3 months because some of the townsfolk travelled to Nevada City, the nearest big municipality, to buy some alcohol for their 4th of July celebration, to celebrate Independence Day. So they were still, you know, they thought it was worth celebrating a great American holiday, even though they were now a great republic. And the story goes that they were turned away for being foreigners. And the people in Nevada City refused to sell them any booze. And so when they got back home to tell the other people in the Republic of Rough and Ready, the town immediately voted to rejoin the Union.
Amazing.
Their hearts really weren't in it, were they?
Yeah.
They were like, well, we don't want to be a foreigner. We'll be American. Oh, yeah. We want to be American.
Yeah.
It's got real strong asking the boys who look old enough to go and buy booze for you vibes. And then when they don't succeed, going, well, I'm just going to be a Puritan now.
They've gone, you know, we're going to be independent. Oh, we don't have any booze, though. Oh, fuck it.
And they became independent in order to avoid prohibition.
Yeah. Yeah. But none of them thought to set up a distillery in the three months. So our candidates this week for the world's worst country are Ben's suggestion of the Nation of Celestial Space, Celestia, founded by the dreamer James Thomas Mangan. Mark's suggestion of the Shetland Island of Forvik, ruled by the benevolent Captain Calamity, Stuart Hill. And my suggestion of the Great Republic of Rough and Ready, the country which, but for an off license, would still be with us today. I love Forvik, and I love Stuart Hill, and I love the... It's a classic micronation story that, you know, eccentric guy shows up, decides this is a country now, and maintains that fiction for the rest of his sad life. And he's kind of emblematic of so many of these rubbish little countries. I love the Republic of Rough and Ready because of like the half-heartedness of the effort that they made, but I think the sheer ambition of James Thomas Mangan and Celestia, and the audacity of declaring outer space and everything in it a country despite the fact he'd never been there, and issuing passports to the moon, like his commitment to the bit was really, I think that's what shades it for me. So I think I'm gonna pick Celestia as the world's worst country. And so
I think it's a good choice. Well done, Ben.
Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week. We're maintaining our best news output until you know, we get some better news in the real world. And did any of you see the story in the Guardian about a lovely dog sitting outside a hospital in Turkey?
No.
Oh, mates. First of all, the headline is brilliant. It says, patient dog waits for days outside hospital. Surely, if it's a patient, it should go into the hospital. But no, this is a dog in the city of Trabzon in Turkey. Her owner, Kemal Senturk, is being treated. And this dog, Bonchuk, which means bead, followed the ambulance that brought her owner to the hospital on the 14th of January. And she's been making daily visits to the hospital. Her owner's daughter keeps bringing the dog home, and the dog just keeps running back to the hospital. Doesn't go inside. The security guard says that she comes around every day at around 9 a.m. and waits until nightfall. She doesn't go in. When the door opens, she pokes her head inside and then sits outside again. You'll be glad to hear that on Wednesday, the 20th of January, her owner was reunited with her because he was pushed outside in a wheelchair. He said, she's very used to me and I miss her too constantly. He was discharged home and returned home with the dog by his side.
That is absolutely the good news we all need. And I think we need to include that in the documentary I'm making.
Absolutely. It's a much nicer version of the Grey Fires Bobby story, isn't it?
Yes.
Before we go, Mark, where can people find out more about you and your documentary work and everything else that you're doing, and Map Men and so on?
Well, I think probably the only thing that I would need to plug is Map Men, which is on YouTube. It's on Jay Foreman's channel with all of his wonderful other content as well, and it is just called that, Map Men. There's about 13, 14 episodes out, and we're sort of bringing new ones out every month at the moment as well. Yeah.
Yes, excellent. It's a really worth. My husband is a devotee of all of the videos on there.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
So yes, do go check them out. Meanwhile, we're all off to visit the nation of celestial space. If only we could find an airplane willing to take us there. Thank you for listening to The Horse and Forge. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.